The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, a look at the call to defund police.
Law enforcement, here's the controversial statement, is the one necessary profession. Every other profession is contingent.
Police departments battle the union over bad cops.
Sometimes they even fire them and they're forced to rehire them.
Dr. Albert Mohler gives us an historical perspective.
I want to help Christians connect the dots in our time.
And he looks at the dramatically changed two-party system.
The tipping point was somewhere around 1972 in that election where the two parties just began to absolutely veer off into completely different directions.
I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. You can catch my program each day through our live stream at WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. Most of us know people in law enforcement. Some have family members. I'm certain a good number of the listeners of the Christian Outlook are part of that force. Rarely has there been a time when a segment of society that is so vital has come under fire as it has recently. The vast majority of police men and women are terrific citizens who risk their lives every day to protect society. And due to the actions of a rogue cop, the world has turned on them. For many, a lifetime of service has been trashed in a season of endless vitriol toward their profession. This is not to diminish what happened to George Floyd, and we have dealt with that extensively in past programs. In this segment, we look at what is happening to the men and women in blue. The talk of defund the police is a troubling attack on what stands between Americans and lawlessness. J. Warner Wallace, a former detective in Southern California, joined the ride home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
It's really a tough situation to be in, to be able to talk about this in terms of defunding the police. Okay, I worked in my agency as a second-generation police officer. My son is the third. And, you know, 25 years that I served in that capacity, I never once got a personnel complaint in that entire time. So all of us kind of respond in terms of what is our practical observational experience. Like, you know, for me, where I worked and how I worked, I just don't see it as far as the kind of interaction. But this does not mean that it's not happening. We have to be careful not to extrapolate our experiences to everybody else, whether they're positive or negative. I know that for a fact that there are police officers who are racist, because in every group, you're going to find somebody who holds this position. And so to say that there are no racist police officers is a lie. But the question is law enforcement in general, are police officers racist, as if to apply that to the broader group? Yeah. And that's where I have a hard time. That was not my experiencing working where I was working. But do I see bad apples in every group? Yeah. As a matter of fact, that was asked by my chief in the last 2 years I was there to run and develop our ethics program for our police officers. Because we do have situations in which people do terrible things they should not do. This is true of every group, right? And when that happens, we have to be able to say, okay, what's the problem? What are we doing wrong here? How is this happening in our agency that we even need to discuss this simple issue, whether it was racism or some other misbehavior? It happens in every agency. But, of course, I didn't have any Christians, really, for the most part, in my agency to work with. And I will tell you, if you're teaching ethics to a group that does not believe there is an overarching, transcendent object of our faith that is kind of watching what we do and actually watches us in private, then what you fall into is some form of utilitarianism, right? Like, hey, don't do that kind of thing, because if someone catches you doing that, you're going to lose your job. So it has a very utilitarian purpose. Don't do things that will get you in trouble. The problem is the human heart is so depraved that we think we can get away without being detected, right? Mm. So what you're saying is, if I get caught, I'm going to be punished. Well, don't worry, I'm not going to get caught. That's the problem. That, of course, under a Christian worldview, well, no, you're always going to be caught because there's a God who knows what you do in private, what you think in private, what your heart is toward other people in private. And of course, that changes everything.
Right. So then, Jim, address that question. Is it viable to defund the police?
Well, okay, so when someone says that, John, they don't always mean it the way we hear it. Sometimes when people say we want to defund the police, what they mean is whatever agency or whatever structure we have in place right now in our city, that has to stop. But it's not working, it's not responsive. So we want to stop paying for that. But they don't mean they're going to stop paying for any kind of law enforcement. They just mean they'll shift to either to a new form, or in some places I've seen that, you know, the county or the state or the region has to pick up the law enforcement responsibility. But there will be some. Now, I'll tell you something very controversial. I'm going to make this statement now, and I know I've taken a risk in making it, but I want to just share it with you, okay? When I was teaching ethics in our agency, and I was trying to impress upon young officers why this job is so critical and why you cannot behave in the way that you're seeing right now on television with the killing of George Floyd, I would say, look, you remember that law enforcement, here's the controversial statement, is the one necessary profession. Every other profession is contingent. Necessary versus contingent. In other words, you can't have a doctor doing his work if he's afraid someone's going to break into his office and steal the money he's got from the last patient or harm him because he was misdiagnosed. You have to have that other thing in place first as the substructure of every other contingent profession. And that thing you have to have first, unfortunately, is order, the enforcement of order, protection of the innocent, right? Yes. Now, of course, it has to be virtuous. And this is why it's so important that it's virtuous, because it is the one necessary profession upon every old town in the United States. When they first formed, the first thing you do is you hire a sheriff. That's why it's so critical that law enforcement be hold the utmost virtue, because it is necessary, and you're going to have to have it in place. And if you have a bad agency in place or a bad system in place, you've got a tyranny. And a lot of folks are reacting to that. They have an experience locally and wherever they are that affirms for them that something is wrong, and they want it fixed. And then the question becomes, well, okay, is it systemically so broken that it cannot be fixed? And I will tell you guys, I think there is a systemic problem with racism, but it's not at the level of government or of even these institutions like law enforcement. It resides in the human heart. Mm-hmm. And because those institutions are filled with humans who have hearts, what I call otherism, it's not even racism, it's otherism, is that we are drawn toward people who are like ourselves and we reject people who are different than us. And I suggest that race is the easy one because you can see that across the street when someone's approaching you. But if all of us were the exact same race, the same color, the same gender, the same age, the same height, we would find some other reason to divide. Because the nature of who we are as fallen humans is to reject things that don't look the same.
The policeman who killed George Floyd had dozens of complaints against him. Rarely was he disciplined, as he was protected by his union. When it comes to police reform, many believe that is the first place to begin. Rachel Gressler of the Heritage Foundation wrote on the topic for the Daily Signal. She joined Georgine Rice on KPDQ in Portland, Oregon.
You point out and remind us that Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey referred to it as this one nearly impenetrable barrier, which is the union contract and the way it's set up. Explain what he meant by that.
Yeah, so as policymakers across the country are looking at this, and even federal lawmakers in Congress, you know, I think that not enough focus is drilling down to what Mayor Frey called this one impenetrable barrier, which is a very local level. You know, each police department having this contract with their union that oftentimes is delegating a lot of the management roles and the oversight and accountability and even some of the disciplinary measures to the union instead of that police chief and that agency being able to be the ones in charge of those things. And while it's not widely reported, it is widely researched and acknowledged, you know, both in academia and just in the examples that are out there, that time and again, these union contracts come in to, you know, limit the ability of the agencies to account for the officers, to discipline them, Sometimes they even fire them and they're forced to rehire them. You know, Washington Post article pointed out that out of 1,881 police officers who had been terminated, 1/4 of them were forced to be reinstated as they appealed through their union. And just the place that that puts those police chiefs in, taking away, you know, what they know to be the best decisions and what they know to be best to protect their community members, it really undermines their authority and prevents them from doing what is needed for the community and for that police agency.
Now, you point out that it's important to remember that not all complaints filed against police officers have merit, but that when complaints are filed, they need to be thoroughly investigated. And when police officers, like two of the officers who are former police officers who have been charged in the George Floyd case, had complaints against them, it's nearly impossible for a chief, although not entirely, it's nearly impossible for a chief of police to have these officers removed. And that's because the unions are doing more than collective bargaining over salary, but other areas as well that make it very difficult to hold them accountable.
Exactly. And I do want to preface all of this in this discussion with, you know, just the great respect and gratitude that I and I think most people have for police officers, the overwhelming majority of whom are heroes who put their lives on the line protecting the communities in which they live and serve. And yet there are instances in which there is abuse and brutality that needs to be appropriately addressed. And the problem comes in when you have these complaints and once they are vetted and you know that it's not just a drug dealer complaining about a cop that they don't want to be pursuing them any longer, but if it's a legitimate complaint, oftentimes the contracts include provisions that will maybe not let that complaint see the light of day. They will obstruct the ability of the chief of police to institute discipline. They'll erase discipline records. They insert elevated standards of review to protect police officers from any discipline. They ban civilian oversight. You know, there's all these provisions, and not in every single contract, but they are, you know, widely out there, and they are frustrating those people who are supposed to be holding the officers accountable, preventing them from being able to do that. Even when they are successfully able to enforce discipline or even to remove a problematic officer, you know, another police chief described how he was forced to reinstate an officer that he had fired not once, but twice, and just how that undermines the authority and prevents them from creating the culture and the community policing that they want.
Coming up, much of what we see in our politics today began long ago.
The tipping point was somewhere around 1972 in that election where the two parties just began to absolutely veer off into completely different directions.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Hi, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. The coronavirus pandemic has made life chaotic and unpredictable for everyone. It's in times like these we search for something we can truly count on. We need a true north. In the current crisis, I believe true north is loving your neighbor as yourself. And we can do that by using our time and talent and resources to help assist someone who is vulnerable or in need. And let's remember, together we'll get through this.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Sometimes a book author's timing is impeccable. And on days like this, a lot of people are asking the question, how did we get here? They're watching the news, bewildered by the actions of so many people. And just as all this begins, Dr. Albert Mohler's book arrives with the title, The Gathering Storm. He was on with Eric Metaxas.
Well, I'm excited just to talk to you in general, but the new book, what is the subtitle of The Gathering Storm? What is the book about?
Well, the subtitle is Secularism and Culture in the Church. It's really trying to help people to connect the dots. And you're an historian. You'll care deeply about this and know exactly what's going on with the title. I've had a fascination with Winston Churchill ever since I was about 13 years old. And a part of what has fascinated me is that Churchill had the ability to connect the dots when others could not or would not. And when he wrote his Titanic 6-volume history of the Second World War. That first volume was entitled The Gathering Storm because it was all about Nazi Germany, its militarism, its rise, and Churchill connected the dots, and Britain's establishment refused to, and many others in Europe as well, and it led to disaster. I want to help Christians connect the dots in our time.
Well, and tell us specifically, Al, where do you connect the dots?
Well, I think the biggest shift in Western culture that Christians should be aware of is the secularization of the culture. And that doesn't necessarily even mean what some people think it means. It doesn't mean that no one's talking about God. It doesn't mean that no one's interested in spirituality. But it means that any binding religious authority, and in our case, the binding religious authority of historic Christianity, has been receding from any authoritative posture in Western society for over a century now. And the process has just reached what we might call warp speed in recent years. And it's left a lot of Christians wondering, how could this happen? How could the entire moral order be turned upside down? And how could it be that the mainstream press now uses the phrase religious liberty in scare quotes? How could this have happened? And you and I both know it didn't happen out of a vacuum. It happened out of an historical context that we could see happening and is accelerating even now. And so defining those terms is important. We talk about a secular America. Clearly, it doesn't mean that religion's illegal, that there's no Christianity. But it does mean that the most influential sectors of our society have either rejected the Christian truth claim or are so distant from it, it's no longer even on their horizon.
Well, something has happened in our lifetimes that is so dramatic. We need to understand, for example, that the Democratic Party is so dramatically different than it was 30 or 50 years ago. They never were a secularist party. They had elements, but they have become a dramatically secularist party. They've pushed out of their platform. There used to be plenty of Democrats, plenty. Right, and these are friends of mine that still vote that way. They don't see what has happened to the party. And Americans need to wake up. I think people are voting for FDR when they vote for the Democrats and not realizing that a JFK and FDR are part of another universe. That was when the Democratic Party was open to basic American values and open to people who respected the Bible and Christian teaching. That is no longer the case. And so that is part of where we are.
It is. You know, there is this increasingly secular divide in the United States, and it's not accidentally a partisan divide, because even as there are two cultures now in the United States in many ways, those cultures naturally organize themselves into political parties for national campaigns. You know, Eric, I think we can see something else. And you're right. If you go back, say, a half century, you could find plenty of people who openly identified with historic Christianity in the Democratic Party. And by the way, there still are. And that includes a large number of African-American Christians in the United States. But when you're looking at the elite culture, you go back to a figure like either Eisenhower or Kennedy. And what we now know, just to make clear, it wasn't so partisan then. What we now know is that the supposedly Protestant Eisenhower, who I do believe had some form of theistic faith, and the acknowledged Roman Catholic Kennedy, neither one of them was very much what they were. Eisenhower was not very Presbyterian, and Kennedy was not very Catholic. The binding authority of Christianity at that point for both of them was pretty cultural. By the way, people would forget that the Kennedy family during that time was avowedly anti-abortion. All that would change in the late 60s and the early 70s. And, you know, the tipping point was somewhere around 1972 in that election, where the two parties just began to absolutely veer off into completely different directions.
You're quite right. There was a cultural consensus. Kennedy was bringing prostitutes into the White House. So anybody who feared that he was, you know, a devout Catholic and would listen to the Pope rather than the American people, the Constitution, you know, we can laugh at that. But the fact is that there was a cultural consensus. We also saw it in Hollywood. Something happened in the 60s. And we have gone over time, slowly, 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 but we've come to a place now which is so dramatically different. And I think that that's why folks like you and I, we have to speak up. And I, you know, I try to explain myself, why have I supported Trump? Have I gone soft on adultery or do I not care about marriage? or do I not care about bluster and hyperbole and boasting? Or it's like, folks, we've got to look at where we are. We've got to read the times. We've got to, I don't mean the New York Times. We've got to read what is happening in the culture, because we are in a dramatically different place than we were, let's say, in 1980. Think of it. 1980, we have a choice between Reagan and Carter. Carter is a born-again Christian who says he's a born-again Christian. His sister is an evangelist. He teaches Sunday school. He believes in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. That's what you have on the Democratic side. We are just in such a dramatically different place. You talked about religious liberty being in scare quotes. How is it that we have a formerly philandering New York Manhattan developer who is the champion of religious liberty? How did this happen? I mean, it's almost funny to me.
Well, it certainly is ironic. I think conservative Christians got, and I was a part of this. I was a young person. I worked in the Reagan campaign. I think conservative Christians in the last part of the 20th century woke up to the reality of politics and began to understand how politics works. What conservative Christians didn't understand is how the culture works. Two different things. And even now when I hear Christians talk about power in the United States, they tend to think about political power. Political power is not irrelevant by any means, but cultural power is actually far more influential in the society. So you mentioned Hollywood. You know, you take the cultural production that comes out of Hollywood, the information industry that comes out of New York, the academic world with higher academia, especially in the most prestigious institutions, and then the leadership of the Fortune 500 companies. You know, sociologists will point out that's a very elite is a loaded term. Let's just say it's a very self-selected group, and they have an agenda, and they're far more secular. And by that, there's no way to exaggerate that. By the way, they are intensely now secular, and the Democratic Party. By the way, both parties at the elite level have connections there. But the reality is that the Democratic Party has organized itself with leadership from those who are trying to move the culture in that direction. So I will have students sometimes, I'll give them a copy of the 1960 Democratic and the 1960 Republican platforms. Here's the thing. If you blot the names out, you can't tell which is which.
Coming up,
the Creator has endowed us with certain unalienable rights. You know, so you take the Creator out of this, then where do those rights come from? Do we give them to each other? That's a horrifying thought.
We continue with Albert Mohler when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. What we view in society today, the shocking images and statements we see, did not happen overnight. The protesters and those who took over a six-block chunk of Seattle did not occur in a vacuum. And the troubling words from progressive politicians and the media are not the product of a brand new way of thinking. The process began some time ago, something we see unfolding in Albert Mohler's new book, The Gathering Storm. Dr. Mohler goes a bit further in his conversation with Eric Metaxas.
Now, what you're saying, Al, this is dramatic stuff. We have come from a time when there was a consensus on the left and on the right. Mm-hmm. It has changed over 50 years. Imagine JFK saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Notice the victim mentality wasn't even there was no identity politics. No. And things have changed so dramatically that JFK's own brother, Teddy Kennedy, you know, became one of these leftists, you know, was willing to sign on unlimited abortion, all these kinds of things. It happened in a short time.
Yeah. And by the way, that story is just extremely interesting, that what you just pointed to, because we know from inside the Kennedy family how that family made the political transition. And it was largely tied to Robert Kennedy's run for president in 1968, and it, of course, with Teddy Kennedy's political ambitions thereafter. It was a very Roman Catholic family. The Roman Catholic family objectively condemns abortion as the murder of an unborn human being. So that's when, this is another way secularization takes place. So the Kennedy family came up with an argument. They brought in some very liberal Catholic moralists, and they came up with the argument that said, okay, we will be personally opposed to abortion, but we will say we will not enforce our religious views on the American people in legislation. Now, that's just a picture-perfect illustration of how secularization happens. It enables people at a certain point to say, hey, I'm Roman Catholic, or like Joe Biden, I'm personally opposed to abortion. But hey, I won't do one thing to limit one abortion, given the policy he has now, even calling for the withdrawal of the Hyde Amendment.
It's this clever division where you say, oh, we're just going to push religion over here into this little religious corner where it can be ignored, and then everything else is going to have secular humanist values. And it was a Governor Cuomo, the previous Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, who famously or infamously said, oh, yes, I'm personally as a Catholic opposed to abortion, but I'm going to now give a pass to everyone can vote for abortion on demand and still pretend that they're privately against it. It's really sophistry, and it was an evil thing, and we're living with it today.
Well, we certainly are. And, you know, what we're talking about here is that, for instance, they will say, well, the claim that an unborn child is a person is a theological claim. There's no role for theology in public policy. But of course, every policy is determining whether or not we believe the baby in the womb is a human person. Because if that baby is a human person, and you and I know that baby is, then that baby possesses the same rights as a born person.
By the way, Al, you don't even need to go to abortion. Let's just talk about slavery. Imagine I say, I believe in the Bible, and the Bible says Black Americans are human beings, and it's 1850. And somebody says, that's a religious view. So you keep your religion out of politics. And by the way, if you don't like slavery, well, then you don't buy a slave and let me do what I feel like doing. That's effectively the argument.
Well, and it shows the impossibility of a pro-choice argument. That was Lincoln's whole argument during the war. There's no such thing as a pro-choice argument when it comes to something as abominable as slavery. You're talking about the fact that every society is going to take a position. And everything comes down to whether or not the society takes the right position. Eventually, you're going to have to decide questions of personhood, just as we talked about. And of course, we're living in a time in which secularization has gone so far that you have people who are claiming all kinds of rights, but they have no grounding for those rights. You know, you and I know that even the founders of this country grounded those rights in nature and nature's God. The creator has endowed us with certain unalienable rights. You know, so you take the creator out of this, then where do those rights come from? Do we give them to each other? That's a horrifying thought, because any government that can give us those rights can take away those rights.
All of these things, we're needing to be re-educated. And I know that in your book, The Gathering Storm, that's part of what you're doing.
Yeah, I want people to understand that the battle over religious liberty didn't come out of nowhere. And it's the inevitable collision between people who think that our society should not only tolerate, but respect religious truth claims, and a society that says those religious truth claims have no place in an intelligent, polite society. And this very constitutional order was premised on the first. I mean, the Soviet Union was premised on the second. And yet we have people today, and look, they're haunted, Eric. Given your role and what you do, you know this, they're haunted. They're haunted by someone who comes in and says, God says, and because they don't believe God says, or say they don't believe God says. But we as Christians know they're haunted by this. And that's why there's a particular vehemence right now towards Orthodox Christianity.
Coming up,
we're now in two Americas, voting two different ways.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. These trying times have pitted neighbor against neighbor, brother against sister, even spouses against each other. In this segment, Dr. Albert Mohler examines where we are today, a clearly dangerous time in society. one that exploded into chaos in recent weeks. He continues his conversation with host Eric Metaxas.
I find it in all of the, first of all, you have this flight to anxiety and the psychotherapeutic, you know, even in the mid-century of the last century, people said that's the new ersatz religion.
Yeah.
But I notice it right now. I mean, the New York Times, just a couple of Sundays ago, ran a front page article on the future of Christianity. Now, it's arguing for this radical grunge, you know, kind of postmodern Christianity. But, you know, a secular society doesn't need any kind of spirituality, right? If you're really secular. But the problem is, God did not make us so that we can actually operate in a secular way. It reminds me of the fact that Richard Dawkins, the most acerbic of the leading atheists, you know, had to do an interview in which he admitted he loves Christmas music at Christmas, Christian Christmas music, Anglican Christmas music at Christmas.
Yeah.
And there's just something there that even the most ardent secularist can't get away
when
from.
When you say they're haunted, the issue, of course, is that you cannot run from your maker. You can pretend to, you can shut him out. You can go blah, 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 you know, to drown out the voice of God. But the voice of God is screaming from every cell, from every atom within us, because we cannot escape. It's as if he signed his painting. Every part of us is touched by him. And so you're quite right.
Romans 1.
That are writhing because they can't stand it. They want to get away from themselves.
You know, in the 14th Psalm, the first verse, we read, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Now, when I was a young person and I read that, I thought, well, that just means atheists aren't intelligent. But then I met atheists and they're very intelligent. So what does that mean? Well, the biblical concept of the fool is self-delusional. And the key words I came to understand in that verse were "in his heart." The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. In other words, he knows better. She knows better. And that's the haunting I'm talking about. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, just also a few days ago, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, you know, purchased this full page ad in the New York Times to make fun of Jesus and prayer. Now, it takes a certain amount of venom to pay all that money for a full page ad in the New York Times to say you don't believe in prayer and to caricature Jesus. Yeah. That's not secular. That's hatred.
I have to tell you, only recently, because I'm writing a new book, I've been reading some of the atheist arguments. I always had ignored them. I was bored by them. I read a little bit of Christopher Hitchens' book, God is Not Good, and God is Not Great. And it was so bad that I was actually stunned that somebody as intelligent as Christopher Hitchens could write something so ridiculous. I mean, he's just unable to deal with the logic. And so what he does is he takes brilliant pot shots after pot shots. And so I read a little more recently, and I really have been overwhelmed at the paucity of any actual arguments on the atheist side. It's really embarrassing. In other words, it's nothing but public relations. They don't have the arguments. And so they figure if they can keep making fun of Christians and talking in clever ways, that's the most they can do, because the arguments they don't have.
Yeah, it's a public relations battle. And if you look at the classic atheists of the early 20th century, people like Bertrand Russell or the logical positivist A.J. Iyer, you look at those figures, you know, they were cool. They had dispassionate prose. What I think marks the atheism that we're confronting right now is just anger.
Yeah,
they're angry. And they say they're angry at God. I think in a lot of ways they're angry at Christians. They're angry that we will not get out of their way. You know, it's these pesky Christians who keep showing up, whether the issue is abortion or sexuality or marriage, or you just go down the list. It's just these Christians just won't get out of the way.
Well, it's funny, because it's not as though they don't have a lot of valid criticisms of the church, but valid criticisms of the church, guess what? You have them and I have them, and Martin Luther had them, and anyone with a brain who is a Christian has criticisms of what passes for Christian faith. There's no question about that. And that's the role. We're supposed to be truth seekers. We're supposed to be. Jesus himself was a religious reformer, if you just look at him historically. Mm-hmm. And yet they act as though, by giving voice to those criticisms, the only option is to leap into atheism, which is, you know, it's really like saying that if anything's wrong with the world, we should all kill ourselves. It's really not a great option.
No, and you know, I learned a long time ago that when somebody reaches the point where their argument turns into sarcasm, they've run out of argument. And you mentioned Christopher Hitchens, because Christopher Hitchens was capable of such incredible prose. But when he wrote God is Not Great, or and other things like that, he just writes with venom. And you know, I can't even imagine the atheists enjoy reading that kind of venom too much. It doesn't make for good bedside reading for the atheist trying to go to sleep. And that anger, look, it's pointing at something. And I think, again, there are deep biblical roots for this. But we're living in this moment. And that's the reason I wrote this book, The Gathering Storm, is the reason why you write so many of the things that you write. You're timing them for the big questions of the age. And people are asking, why is everything now so difficult? What? And, you know, when we were talking about the two parties and polarization in the United States, and we mentioned the right and the left. Look, in the 1950s, the Democrats did their very best to keep the left away from the Democratic Party. In the 1950s, the Republicans did their very best to keep the right away from the Republican Party. Those two parties saw themselves in the mainstream. Goldwater changed that, and Buckley and Reagan and all the rest in the Republican Party. And George McGovern and an entire array of figures changed that on the Democratic side. And those trajectories have just gone on and on and on and on. And so when we come to November of 2020, I mean, I just can't believe people ask me, you know, what about swing voters? I mean, unless you don't have a clue what's going on, there's very little swing. You know, we're now in two Americas voting two different ways.
People need to understand where we are. And the idea that you could be so culturally and politically ignorant that you could think not voting is an option because I don't like either guy. Well, guess what, folks? You're on the hook. God will judge you if you don't vote. In other words, you can't pretend that you can't just say, well, I'm just going to stick my head in the sand. I'm not going to look. I'm not going to look. You are responsible. If you're an adult of voting age, you're responsible and you need to make a choice. And there are going to be people whose lives are going to depend on the choice you make, including not voting.
Coming up,
if that party gains control, I have just tremendous concerns about the future of religious liberty and the future of human life. And the things I care about is even being pre-political. So, you know, there's no joy in politics. And for Christians, there's never satisfaction in politics. But there is a political stewardship.
Dr. Albert Mohler explains why he will vote differently in 2020 than he did in 2016. When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. When Donald Trump was a candidate in 2016, his presidential run put many Christians in a difficult position. Many, perhaps a majority, were not pleased with his recent past or the many things he said and did prior to running for office, let alone what he said while running for office. But in deciding between Trump and Hillary Clinton, most evangelicals pulled the lever for Trump. As president of the Southern Baptist Seminary and a prominent theologian, men like Dr. Albert Mohler had a lot of people asking, what do you plan to do? Here he is, one more time, with Eric Metaxas.
Pretty recently, you've taken some tremendous criticism from people who are just viciously angry that you dared to say that you thought it was the wise thing at this point to vote for Trump in the reelection. Why did you make that statement?
Well, it is because of the very things we're talking about here. And so I want to be really, really clear. I reluctantly did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016 and was very public about that. I now think that would be the wrong decision in 2020. And so you might say I'm reluctantly voting for Donald Trump. At least I certainly plan to. But it's because he's not the candidate that I would choose as a traditional conservative. But he's the candidate at the top of the ticket. And when you look at the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, I don't want to panic. I don't panic. But if I think about that Democratic Party, which is, by the way, of all things, moving increasingly to the left, even as it faces a general election campaign, never happened in American history.
Nope.
If that party gains control, I have just tremendous concerns about the future of religious liberty and the future of human life. And the things I care about is even being pre-political. So, you know, there's no joy in politics. And for Christians, there's never satisfaction in politics. But there is a political stewardship. And I pray to be a good and faithful steward of that political opportunity.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of people feel betrayed by you. That's where their anger comes from, because, you know, 4 years ago, you on principle said you weren't going to vote. I think a lot of people felt that with me. They thought surely Eric Metaxas wouldn't stoop to vote for, you know, a monster like Donald Trump. So there's a lot of feelings of betrayal and anger. But you know, and I know that a vote for Trump in many cases is not a vote for Trump. In other words, when you vote for the man, you are also voting from Mike Pence as his vice president. And he has picked so many other outspoken Christians like Pompeo and Carson and Betsy DeVos and others whose names aren't coming to me. And we need to understand, you can still hate Trump, but when you're voting for him, you're voting for just an array of people with biblical values. And if you vote for the other person or don't vote, you're getting people who are not only not on the page of biblical values, but they're vicious. They've become vicious enemies of biblical values. And we need to deal with that.
Yeah, you know, I think we all have to deal with the question, what will the culture look like 4 years after the election? What policies are going to be in place? Who's going to sit on the Supreme Court? Who's going to sit in the federal judiciary? Who's going to be making the rules for the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Education? Will Christian schools be able to have Christian morality on a college campus? I don't believe that's going to be true if the Democratic Party is in power. And it's not because I'm making that up. They've told us ahead of time what their plans are.
Thanks for joining us today. If you liked our program, take a moment to share it with a friend. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.